welcome to the A-News Podcast. This is Episode 8, April 22nd. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the last week and beyond. This podcast is designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Please give us feedback and constructive criticism at our email address, podcast@anarchistnews.org. Most stories here have information and are cited at the non-sectarian anarchist news site, anarchistnews.org. On our minds this week, the March for Science and the legacy of Paul Feyerabend. This weekend, there have been several marches around the U.S. billing themselves as the March for Science. Here is some of their self-description. Quote, "The March for Science is the first step of a global movement to defend the vital role science plays in our health, safety, economies, and governments. The March for Science champions robustly funded and publicly communicated science as a pillar of human freedom and prosperity. We unite as a diverse, nonpartisan group to call for a science that upholds the common good and for political leaders and policymakers to enact evidence-based policies in the public interest." Unquote. While on the one hand, we are sympathetic to the idea that the government doesn't exactly use evidence from the real world to make its decisions, we reject the idea that any regime has been that rational. Politics and the so-called scientific method have never been comfortable friends, and they aren't today. An anarchist who was in the academy and had some good ideas about this relationship was named Paul Feyerabend, and he described science as being essentially anarchistic, obsessed with its own mythology, and is making claims to truth well beyond its actual capacity. He was especially indignant about the condescending attitudes of many scientists towards alternative traditions. For example, he thought that negative opinions about astrology and the effectivity of rain dances were not justified by scientific research, and he dismissed the predominantly negative attitudes of scientists towards such phenomena as elitist or racist. In Feyerabend's opinion, science has become a repressive ideology, even though it arguably started as a liberating movement. Feyerabend thought that a pluralistic society should be protected from being influenced too much by science, just as it is protected from other ideologies. He defended the idea that science should be separated from the state in the same way that religion and the state are separated in a modern, secular society. He envisioned a free society in which all traditions have equal rights and equal access to the centers of power. For example, parents should be able to determine the ideological context of their children's education instead of having limited options because of scientific standards. According to Feyerabend, science should also be subjected to democratic control. Not only should the subjects that are investigated by scientists be determined by popular election, but also scientific assumptions and conclusions should be supervised by committees of lay people. He thought that citizens should use their own principles when making decisions about these matters. He rejected the view that science is especially rational on the grounds that there is no single common rational ingredient that unites all of the sciences, but excludes other modes of thoughts. If you'd like to learn more about Paul Feyerabend, check out his book Against Method and his book Science in a Free Society. Editorial. Free speech. When one first finds anarchism, it comes as a surprise how deep it goes, how far the anarchist imagination roams in one's life and practices, if allowed. All of the freedoms one learns about as a pupil in the American education system comes under review. Universal suffrage, the rights of states, and even the idea of jurisprudence are all grist for the mill. Free speech is a hard one, though. One of the reasons that freedom of speech continues to be so popular, from mainstream liberals to straight out of 4chan alt-writers, is that it seems like such common sense. If you want a society where people do not feel repression by their government, then let them say as much. And look at how many, and which, countries appear to suppress free speech. How can that be seen as a better option? It can't. The private anarchist position has to be against what is called free speech, because free speech cannot actually exist outside the context of real freedom, of true freedom. The basic absurdity of free speech is that it always lives in the context of those forces that protect it, not a context of basic respect or the power of those who say things to do anything about what they're saying. We recognize that free speech has consequence, that speech has consequence. If we say something outrageous, we tend to get hostile responses. Even if we keep our communication on the realm of the merely symbolic, like burning a flag, we can suffer real-world consequences. When our political adversaries defend their behavior on the grounds of free speech, they're not just claiming a moral high ground, they are making a case that they should not suffer the consequences of their actions. Is this true? In the political maelstrom of American outrage politics in 2017, it is not socially acceptable to stand against free speech. But it has to be stated that the context of free speech now is that we're living in is extremely narrow and constrained. We as anarchists should work towards returning this conversation back to historical issues of offensive content like Geiger's Landscape XX or Two Live Crew, which was a band from the 80s that was sued for its offensive, very descriptive lyrics, rather than personality-driven content that propels the careers of people like Milo and Ann Coulter. Let the shocking aspect of free speech conversations return to issues of the libertine rather than the meathead libertarian. Anarchists should only speak of free speech as a component of what constitutes freedom. Freedom means the freedom to act and not merely the freedom to say things. It's the freedom of love, passion, critique, not of flags, assholes, and bullies. Flags, assholes, and bullies may exist within an anarchist world, but they would be marginalized to a small part of our existence rather than the center of our conversations and weekend activities. What's new this week? This week we're going to mix up the format a little bit. The transitions between the stories was awkward in the past, so this week we're going to change it up a little bit.
The first story is Antifa anarchists march in the heart of a fascist area in Athens, Greece. There's a video attached to this showing anti-fascist anarchists in Greece marching to see if fascists will attack when people are actually ready for them. The fascists do not.
Between war and retail meltdown, an interview with Peter Gelderloos. This is an interview on IGD with longtime radical author Peter Gelderloos, who speaks here on topics from current and future changes in employment, how it was predictable that Trump would bomb someplace, especially someplace associated with Russia.
Black bloc clashes with fascist groups and Trump supporters in Berkeley, California. This is the first of the stories on April 15th in Berkeley, when Antifa counter-organized against fascists. This news post is quite short and points to a video of some of the action.
Report from the Berkeley Potluck Against Fascism, article number 2 regarding the April 15th events. This report back is from a few folks who went to the event together and gives a more detailed account of some of what happened that day, including inadequate numbers on preparation on the anti-fa side, and some of the police actions, like confiscating picnic food and disallowing sound equipment.
The life and work of anarchist Omar Aziz in the Syrian Revolution. This piece is a retrospective of Aziz, who was active during the Syrian Revolution until his death in 2013. He co-founded the first of the local committees in Syria. Local committees formed a network to promote and report on protests during the revolution. Quote, Aziz was encouraged by the revolutionary wave gripping the country and believed that ongoing demonstrations were able to break the dominance of absolute power. But he saw a lack of synergy between the revolutionary activity and people's daily lives. For Aziz, it didn't make sense to participate in demonstrations demanding the overthrow of the regime while still living within strict hierarchical and authoritarian structures imposed by the state. He described such division as Syria being subject to the overlapping of two times, the time of power, which still manages the life activities, and the time of revolution, belonging to the activists working to overthrow the regime. End quote.
Easter is an empty ritual, just like the fights in Berkeley. This is from a blog post. While this article might not be entirely about the April 15th events in Berkeley, it does reference it. And as the title implies, the piece compares Easter to the ritual of political protests that are symbolically tired or empty. It ends with the following paragraph. Quote, "Take heart, comrades, and enjoy your dinners. Enjoy your time with friends and family, not because it's what you're supposed to do, but because you actually are. And if you're not, well, pull out a bottle and get hammered. Summon an ancient fertility deity. Invoke Jesus and jam nails through your palms. Stop chasing the forms of what life, celebration, and political meaning are supposed to be, and start crafting your own. Skip the choreographed fight and find where the Nazis are staying. Trash their hotels. Slash their tires. Wait lurking in alleys until the fights are over. And when the enemy is weak and tired on the way home, pounce on him with fresh strength and vigor. Go where the cops aren't and really raise some hell." End quote.
Inside the underground anti-racist movement that brings the fight to white supremacists. This is a piece from leftist magazine Mother Jones, and it's a timely article that discusses the Tinley Five, some folks, including at least one anarchist, who were arrested for taking the fight against fascism to the fascists rather than waiting for them to organize something and then responding. The article is sympathetic, and it goes into the local history that was context for the Tinley attack, and is timely because it comes on the heels of the events of April 15th in Berkeley and conversations against what are the best tactics against fascists.
Why the alt-right are weak and why they're becoming so dangerous. This is a piece from CrimeThink on why anarchists should take the alt-right seriously. The underlying question that this article addresses is the long-standing one of why don't more people agree with anarchists. Quote, "Although bullies can appear to be powerful, everything they do to wield power only disempowers them. To have real power, you have to be based in a community that supports you in freely disposing of your potential as you see fit, which requires building meaningful ties with those who are different from you. Bullies give up on this, relying on force in their relation with others rather than the interchanging care. Lacking any sense of self-worth, having given up on accomplishing anything meaningful to enrich others' lives of their own, the only form of pride that remains to fascists is membership in an abstract category. They do not consider themselves valuable as individuals, but only as citizens, white people, Western chauvinists, members of a gang. This is the consolation prize of identity, reserved for weak individuals who feel they have no value on their own merits." Unquote.
A lament for criminality. Shadow Smoke, a regular commenter from Canada, posts this article on pot culture, youth, and mortality. Quote, "But back to weed, by way of conclusion. I am in a lamentful mood because this might be the last 420 that is criminal, and it's obvious that weed being criminal is part of what made it an object that had something to do with counterculture. I wonder if anyone will want to still gather on the mountain, even take the risk of skipping school to attend, once weed is legal, taxed, and corporate. I am certain that all the people who made money selling and growing weed and thereby afforded themselves a slightly more dignified and rewarding means of making money in this society will struggle to figure something else out. Meanwhile, a bunch of capitalists have already set themselves up to dominate the market as soon as the hat finally drops. It looks a little bleak from my perspective." Unquote.
On the role of Black Bloc, a critical look. This is a piece from the 1st of May Anarchist Alliance, which says about themselves, quote, "As individuals and as members of M1 AA, we are active in our communities and workplaces with the labor unions and through formations such as the IWW and Solidarity and Defense. We do not see ourselves as a regional organization. We instead seek broad transnational alliances." Unquote. This critique of the Black Bloc reflects one we read on this podcast a few weeks ago, that the Black Bloc is intimidating or just off-putting to the people anarchists should be appealing to. In the case of a diverse working class, quote, "We should not assume or expect that people will have a context for Black Bloc. The actions around the 4th Precinct in Minneapolis in 2015 illustrated this point. As soon as a masked white supremacist shot a Black Lives Matter protest, well-intentioned anarchists had arrived masked up. This caused confusion among the community and thus required unnecessary intervention. The problem is that the whole thing is either alien to a lot of people or brings up negative connotations. These problems can be addressed by cultivating relationships, having community ties, and having people see the use of Black Bloc when it makes sense over time. This means engagement, and engagement requires some degree of approachability from the start. Unquote.
The struggle is not for martyrdom, but for life. Another piece from CrimeThink. One of the things that CrimeThink is very good at is having relationships with people outside of the U.S., which is reflected in a lot of their international reporting. This is an interview with a new group, the International Revolutionary People's Guerrilla Force, or the IRPGF, the most extensive talk yet, and addresses some of the complications of a revolutionary situation. From the IRPGF, quote, "In the final analysis, those who have come to Rojava for ideological reasons or to support the people of Rojava and their struggle feel that they are equal participants in both the fighting and social transformation, while others, at this time a growing minority, who have come with their military experience or a war touristy type attitude, aren't, and in some cases don't want to be, considered equal, claiming to know more about warfare than the local forces on the ground. This can make for tense exchanges and sometimes physical confrontation and intimidation. We, as the IRPGF, are both equal and autonomous participants, and of course, we are allies supporting the people's defense. We do not see them as mutually exclusive. Yet our autonomy is in some ways limited, since we are a part of a much larger struggle with a semi-formalized military structure and set of alliances. We are under the YPG, which means we are under the SDF, which at this point cooperates with some U.S. military forces and those of other Western countries in attacking Daesh. We see this as pragmatism, and of course, this does not change our opinions that the U.S. is as much our enemy as Daesh or any state for that matter. Yet we also recognize that since it is the foreign policy of the U.S. that eventually led to the creation of Daesh, they ultimately must be responsible for combating them." Unquote.
The state of emergency and the totalitarian drift of the state. More from CrimeThink. This time, about France, which, like the U.S. and other European states, is responding to global shifts by becoming more tyrannical. Quote, "France is proud to be the homeland of human rights, but chartered rights granted by a government or sovereign state can also be revoked on account of real or imagined emergencies. Like people in the United States, we live in a country that can deny rights and put people on lists, often for purely political reasons. After the attacks coinciding with the declaration of a state of emergency, the president proposed inscribing in the Constitution a la déchéance de nationalité, the ability to revoke the French nationality of any person committing an offense, constituting an attack on the fundamental interests of the nation. This proposal has been withdrawn, formally speaking, but it continues in practice." Unquote.
How the government is turning protesters into felons. This is a surprisingly sympathetic piece from Esquire magazine. The article discusses how the government is stepping up its fight against anyone who steps out of line, something that should not be surprising to any anarchist, but is still worth tracking. Quote, "A New York Times article published 2 weeks after the inauguration about anarchist protests accorded just half a sentence to the fact that a Yiannopoulos supporter in Seattle shot and seriously injured an anti-fascist activist and has yet to face charges. 15 paragraphs down, a mere mention was given to the mass arrest of the 200-plus anti-fascist protesters on Inauguration Day. The fact that these arrestees now face felony riot charges went unmentioned by the Times. Blanket charges, which carry a heft unheard of in the last decades of protest history. In my over 30 years of practicing law, I've never seen anything like this," said veteran D.C. attorney Mark Goldstone of the charges. Goldstone, who has defended dozens of activist cases and is representing six of the J20 defendants, called the charges unprecedented territory, unquote.
To be an anarchist, Royman Rodriguez. Rodriguez is an anarchist in Spain who was arrested and tortured in 2015 for anarchist activity, mostly around housing, in Gran Canaria. Here he ponders, in a way that reflects some writings by Voltaire and Duclair, on what actually makes an anarchist talking or doing, and the, some would argue, inevitable tendency of members of a group to talk a better game than is walked. Quote, "My anarchism is something else. My anarchism does not serve to separate me from others, but to approach them. It serves to understand the contradictions of others and see how much of them are in me. It serves to accustom myself to demanding nothing of others beyond what I demand of myself. I don't want to be an anarchist of something difficult or torturous, but rather something easy, accessible, and within the reach of everyone. I reject Emile Armand when he says that anarchism is not for those inept for effort. I refuse this. I don't want an anarchism for intellectual athletes or champions of abstract thought and ubermensch from some Leni Riefenstahl documentary. I want an anarchism precisely that can be the patrimony of all those who have up till now been excluded from the summits of minds, the committees of the wise, and from the classrooms and academies. I want that we who are branded cripples, physical and mental, that we can make anarchism ours and to spit it in the face of those who relegate it to the universities, the salons, the collectives of the converted and study groups. I want that this anarchism of daily life that is woven in our many relations, in our neighborhood assemblies, in our common kitchen pots, in our gardens, on our picket lines, in our conflicts in the neighborhood, ends up being accepted as a quick and efficient way of becoming an anarchist, without necessarily calling anyone that, without taking on any folklore, nor sharing any fetishism of flags, symbols, or initials." End quote.
Venezuela. Anarchists speak out against the charter of the OAS. Even the U.S. corporate media has been noticing the almost daily protests in Venezuela, although of course they focus on the protest as being against a specific government. Here, from Insurrection News, is a report from Venezuelan anarchists that points out both the specific issues with the particular government and the anarchist dedication to freedom from all states.
Sabotage against train tracks in Olympia. A communique about an action that seems to be easily reproducible. Quote, "We were inspired to take this action by acts of resistance taking place across Turtle Island and the world, particularly the fierce indigenous resistance of water protectors against the Dakota Access Pipeline. The encampment blocked a train full of track materials on those same tracks in Olympia this past November, and the clandestine attacks against pipelines in Florida, South Dakota, and Iowa. We were also emboldened by the spirit of all those who have risen against the white supremacist police in Ferguson, Baltimore, Oakland, and elsewhere, as well as by the riotous opposition that has characterized the first few months of Donald Trump's reign." End quote.
Mexico City. Explosive attack against Exxon by informal feminist commando of anti-authoritarian action. Originally from Contra Info, translated by Insurrection News, this is a communique about an action against Exxon in solidarity with anarchists of the Aachen case in Germany, comrades in Korydallos prison in Greece, and Pola Ropa, who attempted a daring prison break by helicopter in Greece. Quote, "But the most important manipulation that lies at the heart of this new version of spreading fear is the ideological return to the nationalism that lies within the needs of the current reconfiguration of capital. A truly fascist, chameleon-like theatrical performance. But what do they mean by the people of Mexico? When what we have here is a prism of different faces disputing territory and power, oppressing one another in constant conflict, let's take off the veil of nationalist fetishes immediately. Belief in the nation only perpetuates racism. Let's get rid of the ideological chain of belief in, quote, the people, end quote. Belief in the people only limits the free development and self-affirmation of the human will. They are nothing but binding ghosts," unquote.
In media projects, we're actually a little light this week. The Anarcho-Tourist Review Issue 2 has come out here in March of 2017. This is a review out of Athens, Greece. The first issue came out in June of last year. This one, the end of March. As part of their introduction, they say, quote, "In this time of generalized societal implosion, we need a greater vision to see the strained beauty of our era of ruins. Great storms lie on the horizon, and with it the shipwreck of an entire era, of a whole shape of the world." Number two addresses Trump, an important postmodern, an impotent postmodern left, symptoms of what they call the slow-motion collapse of civilization in general. Quote, We can only hope that now the mask is off, the illusions of easy solutions will also disappear. There are no more charismatic candidates to delicately conceal the dystopia that we were already living in anyways. End quote. And in podcasts,
Anarchy Radio has a new host site, Radio Free America, with limited navigation options and no obvious ability to download. It starts out this week with Kathyn reflecting on the 47 years since her first arrest at 19. The hosts move on to rejecting the call of anti-fascism as the lowest common denominator issue that distracts from more significant fights. There's a pleased review of an article on Western social collapse from BBC.com. There is talk of Earth Day becoming Science Day, the Facebook murder and screen life in general. As always, there's reports on good actions and bad tech.
Finally, the Post-Proletariat Podcast, Episode 1, Anti-Fascism, the Spanish Civil War, and Berkeley Street Fights. A self-described rantcast by the writer of the blog entry on Redneck Revolt from last week. This is almost 90 minutes of blog posts for the ears. The first episode is a little rough in terms of following a coherent line of thought or backing up any of the assertions made, but first episodes are often rough. He spends some energy on how everyone who is resisting the state should know how to fight, and on the argument that the Spanish Civil War was lost because it was distracted by fighting fascists. So this week, the topic of the week is reflection, and mostly it seems the language in the topic is about sort of how have you changed through failure. And talking with me this week is Ariel.
Hello.
Hey. So what are your thoughts on the topic?
Reflection is good. Definitely a good part of your political trajectory. I actually didn't take away the failure so much of it so heavily, but the part talking about writings and influences, and fortunately I didn't come of age in the social media world, so I didn't have to suffer through being trolled. I'm sure I would have been trolled mercilessly. I came out of liberal democratic politics into anarchist politics, and still believed in the kind of the pressure of social change model, and then I read The Situationists, and The Society of the Spectacle had a profound effect on me.
How?
I was mildly disappointed in how much anarchist gatherings and marches and protests looked like
liberal democratic
marches and protests, and then The Society of the Spectacle framing things in terms of to be seen and defining the spectacle and putting the world in this context of what's accepted and what we throw up to purport a position outside of ourselves. And it made it, the instant meaning I took away from all of it was that, of course, none of it mattered. But then following through, digging a little deeper, it redefined my understanding of our relationship to power and those in charge and the state, and made it seem like that protesting was not actually the path, because we weren't playing on the same field.
Right.
We were behaving as if we were.
Yeah, I think along those lines, my decision to become an anarchist was that I felt like the kind of social reforms that people talked about as being plausible were impossible in the current regime, and that if I were going to have an implausible value system or an implausible political goal, that it should be that anarchism was the preferable one because it was the actual political goal that someone could have. And,
right.
And if two things are equally impossible, why don't you pick the one that you actually want rather than the one that somehow sounds more like adult or responsible or something. You know, for me, the thing I've always loved about anarchism is that it's irresponsible and impossible.
Absolutely.
And just to ask the last question, from this topic, what's your most embarrassing moment as an anarchist?
I was interviewed for a documentary called Boom, The Sound of Eviction, because I worked at a .com in the Valley during the first .com back in the day. And I didn't entirely understand who was making the film and what film they were making, but I'm not sure that would have mattered, because I was very aware of the fact that I was going to not have a job very soon, and I didn't understand who might see my interview. And so instead of being Ariel political Ariel, I was pretty much Ariel employee business Ariel. And so I actually have not been able to bring myself to watch it. And I don't actually remember what I said, but I know enough from memory to know that it was awful, and then have been told by others that it's, well, all kinds of not nice names, and that I just came off terribly. I believe someone who really likes me told me I just came off douchey, which, you know, that's something for sure. So yeah, that would definitely be a big embarrassment, and it's, you know, in the world for you to go see. I'm sure you can find it on YouTube right now.
If you recall, for my 40th birthday, we had a roast.
Yes.
And I definitely recall the person who found the fact that when I was playing video games, I mean, it had to be 20, 25 years ago, whatever video game character I was playing, the name of the character was Chomsky.
That's pretty embarrassing.
Yeah, so 25 years ago, I actually read Chomsky and thought that his foreign policy analysis was interesting.
Well, many of us did. We just didn't immortalize it by naming ourselves after it.
Yeah. Oh, we're actually only 5 minutes in. We should maybe talk about some of these other questions.
Okay, what are some of the other questions?
Well, I guess really this is, for me, I read this as a question about, like, what path did you take? And, you know, I guess for me, the you know, as soon as I became an anarchist, because of the influence by the Situationists, I became a, what we call in the U.S., a post-left anarchist, or an anarchist inspired by the Situationists. And to the extent to which I've moved away from that position now, it's because of my own thoughts and my own sort of research and writing and all the rest. And I mean, I guess I can sort of just leave it there, because your story is probably more interesting than mine to listeners of this podcast. But it is interesting today, the fact that a post-left anarchist is sort of described as like, we're sort of portrayed just as sort of the authors of the post-left documents as being sort of old and grumpy. And that's the aspect of post-left anarchism I feel like I've never enjoyed or found much interest in.
No, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, to me, it's always been about laughter and, I guess, being cruel to the dummies of the left, more than it's been about being grumpy because we don't, for instance, think that protests are a good use of our time. So I guess that's my reflection is, you know, I feel like when I became an anarchist, I sort of, a lot of the fundamentals that I believe now, I believed when I became an anarchist, you know, almost 30 years ago.
I was talking with a friend before I started to record and realizing that when I first became an anarchist, I'm not sure I could have told you what I believed in at the time, because I was walking away from so much, you know, almost a lifetime of belief in terms of democracy and American politics.
And mainstream liberal feminism.
The liberal vision of utopia. And I'm not sure I knew at the time.
Do you know now?
What I believe?
Yeah.
I do. I think it would take me a minute to give you a list, but...
What's the top sheet? What's the important part?
And one of the things I like about anarchy, and one of the reasons I'm here, is, you know, that kind of base list of fundamental, no state, and the old school anarchy, no gods, no masters, and...
Are you an atheist?
Yeah, I am. I'm an atheist. So that always sat okay with me. And I think that there's a, even if you don't take it literally, there's a spirit there that's appropriate, especially in the modern age of, let's call the new gods. I'm going to invoke some Neil Gaiman here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think rejecting that is a good place to start. There has to be, you and I have had this conversation before, and I do agree with you that there has to be a politic where we don't have to equivocate and don't have to compromise and don't have to whimper and can lay out, I absolutely demand these impossible things and that and nothing else and just that. And I don't want to have to compromise about that.
Yeah.
There was a group in the East Bay, oh my gosh, 15 years ago now, that at the time I didn't appreciate exactly what it was they were trying to do and how lofty it was, but now in retrospect I do.
You're talking about Group X?
I'm talking about Group X.
Yeah.
And they wanted it to be large and big tentish in that it would gather many, but definitely be anarchist and definitely, you know, have everyone kind of agree on a position isn't the right way to talk about it, and a set of principles is it being a little too strict, but something in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. and then to kind of have the conversations outward from that point. And it was just a tremendous failure in so many ways on a couple different levels.
You know, one of the goals of Group X, which sort of, there's a huge history here that obviously we don't have the time to talk about now. So it was sort of a proposal and a set of meetings and then a large meeting and then a collapse. But you know, one of the aspirations of Group X was to be a place where if you came to town, for instance, as an anarchist, you would have like a single place to go to sort of meet the people and see what was going on and dial yourself into a project that you might be interested in. And, you know, I hate to say it, but 15 years later, if that project actually did succeed and at least achieve that goal, it would have been a great help.
Absolutely.
For so much. It would have been, it's a real shame.
Exactly that. But organizers, the original initiators, to their credit, it was ambitious and imaginative, and they definitely were doing it in a way that I hadn't seen anybody up to that point, and I was a fairly young anarchist at that point. But I don't know that I can say that there's a lesson I took away from it, but I think about it a lot and I reflect back on what that journey looked like.
Mm-hmm.
and where I sit now, I guess, in comparison to it. And what would it look like if someone tried to do that now?
Oh, it would feel the exact same way.
Yeah, I'm sure that it would. It would be interesting for it to be something that happened offline. And would that change it because it
right.
lived in the offline space instead
different.
Of the online space? I don't know that that would save it.
Just to add a piece of information, the project failed because of basically a race intervention that said that because all the founding documents were done primarily by white people, that it sort of was an invalid exercise to even launch. So it launched outside of that objection, but that objection meant that a body of people left the group and the group didn't reflect the criticism that was made. That's why it would happen again exactly the same
way. For sure.
Way. Yeah.
And there was definitely something in the watching the San Francisco Indy Bay.
The failure in the mid-2000s, yeah.
What was the news called?
It was Indy Bay. It was Indy Bay versus SF Indy Media.
SF Indy Media. Indy Media was the word I was looking for. And watching that shake out. Because at the time, that was a pretty important kind of, I don't know, center point for anarchist politics in the Bay, and that falling apart and the way that affected people politically and socially.
I think some of the people involved didn't realize how much other people were paying attention to that particular collapse.
I think that's absolutely true, because a lot of it was people's personal stuff playing out in public space in a way that arguably may not have been appropriate, but because they were affecting these real big things, it became public. So it was inevitable, I think, and definitely made me think about how we mix, how the mixing of personal relationships and anarchist projects, and you know, how do anarchist projects survive breakups and falling out, and because in the world of business as usual liberal politics, things are usually a little like just a step past that, where those kinds of things don't matter so much, at least in the world that I was in. So I'd never seen that play out before.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Anarchy 101. In this segment, we take questions and some of the answers and responses from the website anarchy101.org. This is a user-moderated Q&A site for anarchists to ask questions and answer on anarchist thought and activity. It has nearly a decade of questions and answers. This week's question, is anarchism left or right? The question is asked by someone named Zero. Is anarchism a left or right-wing philosophy? The first answer is by someone named Lawrence. Anarchism, as a recognizable tendency, unquestionably derives from the history of left-wing politics. The right is suffused with nationalism, capitalism, and institutional hierarchies. These primary attributes run directly against the foundational principles of anarchism. The next answer is by someone named Ingrate. I like Lawrence's answer as a starting point, but I would also argue that anarchism, as a lived practice as opposed to a rigid ideology, transcends the left-right framework, which is ultimately, at least to my thinking, based upon statist politics. The concept of politics being limited to left-right and center is tremendously limiting, and like El Bravo hints at, anarchists do not fit neatly in the fenced-in pastures of the left, having some places where our politics are more similar to the libertarian right. While not generally sharing any actual affinity with these people or their goals, they might call themselves libertarian. But when pushed, they're almost all minarchists, not anarchists, and they still hold tightly to sacred cows like property and worship spooks like the free market. And the final answer is by someone named Straw Dog. While anarchism is broadly and historically associated with the political left, as Lawrence explained, I am confident there are trends and tendrils that can be accurately described as right-wing. For the sake of a starting point, here are the opening lines from the Wikipedia entries for both wings. Left-wing politics supports social equality and egalitarianism, often in opposition to social hierarchy and social inequality. Right-wing politics holds that social stratification and social inequality are inevitable, natural, normal, or desirable, typically defending this position on the basis of natural law, economics, or tradition. Taking a look at the opening for right-wing politics, it's not necessary for one to advocate for social stratification and inequality, but merely to consider it to be inevitable or natural. In this sense, some modes of post-left anarchy would be closer to the political right than left. And texts like Desert are understandable as strictly right-wing in themselves, whatever the politics of their authors. Nihilist positions that find humans to be foundationally unequal or incomparable are also right-wing. Some individualist positions, and certainly egoism, also fall onto the right in this description. Laying aside the definitions for a moment, simply put, there are also self-identifying anarchists within what we'd call the libertarian camp, whose politics are not reducible to anarcho-capitalism, as well as libertarians whose politics, when properly understood, are just post-left anarchy by radically different names. Source: I came to anarchy through extreme far-right state communism and without ever passing through the left. It helps to imagine the circle of American politics as positioned on a sphere. Go far enough in any direction and you can end up anywhere else.
As I thread this lockness, slipstream, sepsis, subconscious of have twits, asterisk, see, off my meds glitch.
This episode of the A-News Podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Lino Mabel, written by Chisel, produced and narrated by Aragorn and Chisel. And thanks to Ariel for their help with the topic of the week. You can contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. You can follow our Twitter at anewspodcast. If you would like to learn more, an introduction to anarchism, anarchy101.org. If you would like to consume books and other anarchist ephemera, littleblackcart.com. And as always, for news and up-to-the-minute commentary, anarchistnews.org. Thank you, and see you next week.